You are listening to C-Suite Perspectives, a podcast series from the Conference Board, providing business leaders with trusted insights for what's ahead.
Welcome to this episode of C-Suite Perspectives, a new podcast series by the Conference Board. C-Suite Perspectives are conversations that take an objective, data-driven look at a range of timely topics that matter most to business executives. To help make sense of these topics and how they'll unfold, we sit down with thought leaders and do what we do best, which is to provide insights for what's ahead. I'm Steve Odlin, CEO of the Conference Board and the host of this podcast series. And in today's conversation, we'll talk about an issue that is front and center in the nation's capital, and that is infrastructure. What's the state of America's infrastructure? Why is reforming it such an economic imperative? And if we make a big investment, who's going to pick up the tab and pay for all of this? Well, here to address those questions and more is Lori Esposito Murray. Dr. Murray is the president of the Conference Board's Committee for Economic Development. CED is the public policy center here at the Conference Board. Lori, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Steve. Very happy to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah. So, you know, Lori, we've been working on infrastructure at CED for a long time, but one of the key things that, you know, you always stumble over is what is infrastructures? And there's lots of definitions out there by business people and certainly on Capitol Hill. What definition should we be using?
So that really is one of the central questions on this infrastructure debate, which is very hot right now on Capitol Hill and especially in the Senate, because their bill will go to the House first. But CED, as you said, has been working on this for a long time. And in February, we released a solution brief, which was a comprehensive plan for infrastructure in the post-pandemic economy. And key to that project by our trustees and our research team was the starting point, which is what is the definition of infrastructure in an advanced economy? And so, of course, all of the traditional physical hard infrastructure is included: surface transportation, roads, bridges, airports, water resources, stormwater, sewerage, drinking water. Energy production is in there. The whole full cycle that we included from actually extraction through delivery. And then, of course, in the 21st century, in a post-pandemic economy, broadband and internet communications are absolutely critical, and that includes cybersecurity and protecting critical infrastructure. So that's where CED has ended up in terms of, as a starting point, you've got to have a definition.
Well, gee, that sounds like a list of everything we do in the economy. What was left out of that?
Well, they're actually, according to the new administration and the president, a lot was left out of that. The president took what was the traditional definition of infrastructure on the Hill and in Congress, which always received bipartisan support, and that was the hard physical infrastructure. And he broadened it even beyond broadband and cybersecurity. And in his Americans Job Plan, which is shared by many Democrats on the Hill in terms of this new definition, it includes human infrastructure, which is care for the elderly and disabled, as well as affordable housing, childcare, you know, elements of human infrastructure or softer infrastructure that they consider critical for the economy. And that was an over $2 trillion bill. He eventually negotiated it down to $1.7 trillion. But what you're seeing now, and this is really what's defining the activity on the Hill, is that this fissure on definition has really what has led to these two different bills that are being considered, or two different approaches. One is a bipartisan approach for infrastructure, which actually embraces the CED definition of infrastructure for an advanced economy, and it includes broadband and cybersecurity. And then there's a second approach, because Speaker Pelosi and the Democratic leadership said they would not go ahead with a bipartisan deal on infrastructure with that definition unless the president's package of human infrastructure was also included. And so the definition debate has actually led to this track of these two different bills coming up. One will be bipartisan if they can negotiate how it's going to be paid for, which I know we will discuss, on infrastructure, including broadband. And the other will be on the human infrastructure components that the president had in the Americans Jobs Act.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, most Americans, when you say infrastructure, you know, think of, you know, roads and bridges and those kinds of things. And they broadened it in the last decade to the internet. And that's really where most of the Congress is as well. So it, I think that's really been the focus of CED and most business groups that talk about this. This whole cost thing, though, is these are numbers that have never been discussed before. I mean, they're talking, you know, the whole federal budget, everything that we spend in America on, you know, on an average year is about $4 trillion. I mean, we're talking about spending more than that on this incremental piece, right?
Exactly. Right now, this second proposal on the human infrastructure piece is at $3.5 billion. And if you add trillion, thank you. And, there's been these numbers are so hard to even imagine in your head that this is the money for one bill, having spent 10 years on the Hill myself. But 3.5 trillion, you add the extra money, which is about 600 billion for the infrastructure bill, and you get to 4 trillion.
Yeah, but of that 4 trillion, the stuff that people are most worried about with just bridges falling down and potholes is just really a small portion of that. And the rest of it is this other stuff, right?
Exactly. That it'll be an extra $500 billion for the roads, bridges, and broadband piece.
Yeah. So that's I think that's kind of the frustration of businesses and, you know, the average American is, well, you know, can we just fix the roads and you know, so that we're sure that when we drive over a bridge that it doesn't fall down, and why can't we just agree to that and get that done before we start arguing about everything else?
Well, and roads to the U.S. Most of the U.S. transports of goods happens on roads. 60% of our transport of goods, which is actually different from what China does. China uses rail. So fixing the roads in the United States would have a significant impact on our gross domestic product.
Yeah. And I think, you know, this is what we saw in the Reagan era too, in the 80s, where we made a big investment in the expansion of highways, the expansion of railways, the expansion of ports and so forth. And people argued at that point in time that it was an incredible waste of money because, gosh, we'll never use it all. But that really helped to spur the economic boom of the next 20, 25 years, because we used up that capacity that was built. And now we're kind of out of capacity again, right?
Exactly. The American Civil Engineers Organization puts rates our infrastructure at a C-, and says that delays that are caused by traffic congestions, for example, alone cost the economy $120 billion per year. So revitalizing the economy is absolutely critical, and revitalizing infrastructure as the key component of what drives the growth in our economy and allows us to function economically.
Yeah. Now, the funding for all of this, of course, is important. If you set aside the $4 trillion, if you think about the $600 billion, the funding for that comes from a variety of sources. Of course, the federal government provides some, but a lot of it comes from state and localities, and a lot of it is private money. And even on the interstates, which is, you know, the U.S. federal interstate, people think that that's all federal money, but it's not. To help us understand where all the money comes from for this.
So it's actually the federal government is central and key in this. And it provides money to the states and localities through grants and loans, but also through tax subsidies and tax credits. And it also has a very important impact in terms of regulation of private investment. So that's the federal government role. But a significant portion of the actual spending happens at the state level. About 80% of the money spent nationally on transportation and water infrastructure is spent by the states themselves and the local governments, who are stewards of our country's public capital of infrastructure. They own about 90% of the non-defense public infrastructure assets and pay 75% of the cost of maintaining and improving them. So it really is a federal, state, and local organization collaboration in terms of U.S. infrastructure.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there just isn't enough money here to go around, and you're going to see more and more what are called public-private partnerships, which include some federal money, some state money, some local money, and some private money. Talk about how the private money works.
So the private money works basically, so they're called PPPs or P3s, public-private partnerships in transportation and infrastructure. And they're usually, what they are is a concession from a state or local government. It's a contractual relationship. The state and local governments are the owners of the transportation infrastructure, for example, but a private company has the right to develop, build, and then actually charge tolls or user fees to maintain the infrastructure. What's interesting in the U.S. is that P3s haven't really been used that widely. That's in part because of the funding for municipal bonds, for example, is cheaper and easier for states and localities to actually implement. So there's a predisposition to use that type of funding. But in fact, P3s have become much more important because of the decrease in resources that have actually been put towards infrastructure. And so looking to a public-private partnership has actually grown since the Great Recession. And what's interesting in this round of the debate is that both the Democrats and the Republicans who are working on these bipartisan coalitions in the House and the Senate are looking towards private-public partnerships as actually funding this extra, $500 million to $600 billion. That's going to be new money that we're adding to our infrastructure development.
Yeah, but you know, it's one thing to bring private money in and private ownership in for brand new projects. Okay, so you build a toll road that or a toll bridge that didn't exist before. It's brand new and so forth. But isn't it? It's a little harder when you've used public money, the taxpayers' money, over time to build a road, and then you privatize it, which means you basically sell it to a private company after it's been built. That is not as accepted these days. How do you deal with all of that?
Well, and that is the big challenge that's actually facing us today, facing the members of Congress who are trying to figure out how to do these pay-fors for the infrastructure, the bipartisan infrastructure bill. And there's a lot of regulation that goes into this in terms of what happens. And it's going to take, a creative approach by both the state and the local governments and public officials in terms of how they're going to look at working with the private sector. There's also this other piece of it, which is private sector capital that's actually invested into infrastructure. And, countries like Canada actually have more investment with private monies from retirement funds, for example. It's easier to do that. The regulation is actually much more adaptable in terms of allowing that type of private investment. Right now, we do it through management firms that actually invest in these projects, but you could actually do it more. You can model Canada and do it more directly.
We're talking to Dr. Lori Esposito-Murray about the various definitions of infrastructure. We've also covered the role of federal and state governments and private money. Next, we'll take a look at the current state of the infrastructure and ways to finance it going forward. We'll take a short break and be right back.
Interested in this content? You can find this and much more at our Conference Board website, www.conference-board.org. Or, even better, contact our membership team and your company can enjoy the benefits of our in-depth research around the economy, environmental, social, and governance issues, public policy, marketing and communications, and human capital. As a member of the Conference Board, you will be able to have full access to all of our cutting-edge research, leading indicators, benchmarking, and data services, in addition to webcasts and podcasts such as the one you are enjoying now.
Welcome back to C-Suite Perspectives. I'm your host, Steve Odland of the Conference Board, and I'm joined by Dr. Lori Esposito-Murray, the president of our Public Policy Center, the Committee for Economic Development. And today we're talking about all things infrastructure. Okay, Lori, we've talked a little bit about financing of infrastructure, but one of the big sources of money in certainly highway funding has been the gas tax. Now, gas taxes are federal, and as well, every state has it, and it's so gas prices vary state to state depending on the tax levels. But this has been, from a federal standpoint, sort of frozen since the 90s. Why hasn't the gas tax sort of risen with inflation, and why is there such a debate over increasing the gas tax?
Well, today the debate is actually very intense, and the gas tax is at the center of the divide by Democrats and Republicans. You know, I actually find it curious that you know, in a climate, no pun intended there, where climate policies are so important, that the gas tax is as controversial as it is, since it has a very positive effect on if you're looking for a climate risk approach to infrastructure. But given that, it is very controversial, and it's just simply from the administration's viewpoint, and many Democrats on the Hill, or all the Democrats on the Hill, basically at this point, they all support the administration's approach, which is the president made a pledge when he was running not to raise taxes on households' income below $400,000. And so the gas tax is seen as really hitting the lower income end of the American population and increasing cost. And so on the Democratic side, that's why they don't want to increase the gas tax, because of whom it hits. On the Republican side, and among many economists, having user fees for infrastructure is seen as both a very efficient way of raising money, and also a way of making sure that these resources are actually used in very thoughtful and efficient manners as well. That it makes, put simply, people think twice if there's a gas tax, whether they really need to drive or whether there's some other form of transportation they could take. And so you're actually protecting the resources and extending their lifetime.
Yeah, you know, and this argument about it being regressive is an important one, because you don't want it to fall disproportionately on people who can't afford it. On the other hand, the other solutions are no less regressive. I mean, you know, they're talking about tolling, you know, vehicle miles traveled, which, you know, put a transponder on your car and have the government track everywhere you go. That just doesn't seem like a great idea. And of course, you know, vehicle miles traveled would be regressive as well. Then you see these new tolling authorities popping up with all new staff and overhead and administration. But, you know, in some of those cases, nearly 50 cents on the dollar goes to support the incremental overhead rather than truly fund the project. Whereas, you know, every penny in the gas taxes goes, you know, 100% of that goes directly to the road. So it's, you know, isn't it almost sort of pick your poison in all of this?
Exactly. And if you look at user fees, you know, user fees are used to, electricity lines are funded by utility bills. Water and sewer systems are funded through water and sewer bills. Thousands of cell phone towers are, you know, connecting infrastructure are largely paid for by subscribers. So user fees, you know, for very important components of infrastructure is an approach that we use widely. And so having user fees for using our roads and bridges it seems to fall right within the bandwidth of how we approach how we pay for infrastructure.
Yeah. And, you know, so these bills that you've talked about on the Hill right now don't get into any of that. They just increase the debt, and, you know, we print money to do it. But there's a bad thing that can happen after that, you know, in that approach, right?
Right. Well, and also this is very important regarding the infrastructure bill, that the bipartisan approach. They are really trying to find the pay-fors that do not increase the debt. And that is really what is causing some delays here in terms of whether this bipartisan approach will actually make it out. There's a lot of optimism that it will, But just over the past 24, 48 hours, there's concern that the Congressional Budget Office will not give a sign off that what adds the $500 billion new money, which is actually a trillion-dollar bill. This is a compromise bill. It's actually a trillion if you add what we usually reauthorize, plus the new money, that money won't make it with the pay-fors they have. And the pay-fors they're looking at are enforcing IRS tax enforcement, building up the IRS so that it does better tax enforcement. There are concerns now that, one, you have to pay for that type of expansion at the IRS, but two, on the Republican side, there are concerns about how this will be handled, how it will be implemented, and maybe that the money that was projected to come out of that is not as high as some of the projections say. That's one concern. They're looking at use of the COVID funds that have not been used yet, and there are a couple of problems there. I mean, if the money has already been dispensed to the states, particularly as far as the enhanced unemployment insurance goes, you know, can you really get that back? How do you get that back? Or do you tell the states, you know, how do you tell the states who are using those in who have rejected the use of those but are using it in other more creative ways in terms of giving sign-on bonuses if you actually take a job? How do you tell them to reverse course? So they're trying to find the pay-fors for the bipartisan bill without turning to debt. And it's a difficult and hopefully not as lengthy a process. As I said, there is optimism that they'll do it, but now growing concern that it may not be able to get done.
Well, and that's why, you know, you've got this other approach, which is, you know, all one side, which is just spend the money and add it to the debt and we'll sort it out in another 50 years. But, you know, and that the subject of this podcast is not the debt, but we've talked about this before. I mean, the debt is at really very high, historically high levels. I mean, we're 100% of GDP and that's at zero interest rates. I mean, when the interest rates start normalizing, you're going to consume 100% of the budget just to pay the interest on this. And so what happens to future generations if we just keep adding to the debt? And so, again, it's a little rhetorical here, but this is you know, it's a moral issue or an ethical issue in a lot of people's minds.
Well, in COVID, as you know, Steve, we have spent trillions, $6-7 trillion. You add up the bills over the past year and a half, and most of that has just been added, at least $7 trillion of that has just been added to the debt, if not more. And when you're looking at the human infrastructure bill, the $3.5 billion bill that the Democrats are looking at, one of these areas that they're looking at in terms of an alternative to adding to the debt is increasing taxes, corporate taxes, estate taxes, a list of increase of taxes. And, you know, and of course, on the Republican side, there are problems, real problems with that. And so,
yeah, but it's because the math never works. I mean, they always add it up, but the money never comes in because people restructure estates and so forth. So you can raise the rates, but the dollars never seem to come in. And that's been historical. That's been historical results for over 100 years. So that, I think that's it's the math, really, isn't it?
Right. It is the math. And yeah. Needless to say, with the bipartisan infrastructure negotiated bill, the concern by the 11 Republicans in the Senate who are on that is to make sure you don't add to the debt. And yeah. We'll see if they'll be able to get that through.
Yeah. And so then you ask the question, well, okay, so screw it. You know, is it really necessary? You know, can't we just live with what we have? But, you know, you start comparing U.S. infrastructure to the quote unquote competitive nations, and we're really behind. I mean, we really lived off of the investments we made back in the 80s. And then all you end up doing is harming GDP going forward because we don't have any excess capacity to grow into. So then you're right back where we started, which is, how do we compare versus other nations and how urgent is this?
Well, and the comparisons aren't good, Steve. There was the World Economic Forum does a global competitiveness report, and the latest one from 2019 ranked the United States second overall in competitiveness, but 13th in the quality of infrastructure.
Yeah, 13 is not a good number in
in general, right?
In any elevator, yeah,
right, and shouldn't be. You know, most elevators skip 13. You know, we should be right out of that one. And when you compare that to where we are in economic competitiveness, and I would argue it's not necessarily clear that we're second, we're not first, but in any case, those two correlations of economic competitiveness and infrastructure really need to be much more in parallel. You know, in the American Society of Civil Engineers says that we have, it's going to cost $10 trillion overall in terms of GDP if we don't actually invest in the infrastructure that we need to. And that would be by 2039.
That's and you know, in anybody who's got any asset, you know, whether it's a car, whether it's a house, you know, you have to maintain those assets because the value of those assets depreciate if you don't maintain them. So if things are broken down and don't work, the value goes down. And that's where we are. I mean, we've got, what, only a third of the bridges are in good repair. I mean, doesn't that make you nervous when you go out and drive somewhere?
Yes. And, you know, I actually grew up in Fairfield County in Connecticut, just a couple of miles away from the I-95 bridge that collapsed about a decade ago. Just the bridge just fell right down into the river. Not only is it the concept concerning, but actually having lived that reality in Fairfield County, it's very concerning.
Yeah, and there's a lot of examples of that. The I-35 bridge in Minneapolis, and you know, all over the country, you're seeing these things, and so it's not good. And we need a reliable infrastructure to move the goods, keep the GDP going, get to jobs and school. I mean, our lives are dependent on this. So this is a conundrum. We need the infrastructure. We need to keep it in good repair. We need the expansion to grow. And yet there isn't a panacea in terms of a way to fund it. And so this is the big debate.
Yes. And the, you know, as I said, this bipartisan group is working hard on that. And I know you share this, think it's unfortunate that we have to move the gas tax off the table. We have to remove user fees as an option. But they're trying to do workarounds. As I said, they're trying to look for COVID money that wasn't spent. And they're also talking about a national national infrastructure bank. A number of states have these banks. Most of, you know, I think maybe half of the states that have them don't actually use them, but trying to get funding through a national infrastructure bank. We'll see what they come up with, but it is the core element that is causing problems with infrastructure, an infrastructure bill, which has been the story of infrastructure bills for the past, you know, eight years or so. You know, I do want to mention too, though, that you know, when we were talking about economic competitiveness, obviously, China is the country that we are compared with, competing with in terms of economic growth and competitiveness. And China spent an average of 8.5% of GDP per year between 1992 to 2011, and that is when they catapulted from being a developing country into a world-class economic powerhouse.
Yeah, infrastructure is important. Lori, thanks so much for joining us today. Really appreciate all of your thoughts.
Thank you, Steve. Very much appreciate the conversation.
Yeah, we've been talking to Dr. Lori Esposito-Murray about infrastructure and comprehensive look at many of the country's current challenges and solutions. Thanks to all of you for listening to C-Suite Perspectives. We're going to have a new podcast every couple of weeks. We'll be joined by thought leaders in many different areas, talking about public policy, environmental, social, governance, marketing communications, economy, and human capital. So share C-Suite Perspectives with your colleagues and friends, and hopefully everybody will enjoy hearing more about these subjects. I'm Steve Odlin, and this podcast has been brought to you by the Conference Board.
You've been listening to C-Suite Perspectives, a podcast series from the Conference Board that delivers trusted insights for what's ahead to the nation's business leaders. Find this podcast and others from the Conference Board wherever you find your podcasts.